April 7th at the University of the District of Columbia's David A. Clark School of Law, the ACLU of the nation's capital area held a symposium entitled Metro Bag Searches, Know Your Rights, Know the Law. Panelists included David Alpert, founder of the popular blog Greater Greater Washington, James Wettick, a retired FBI agent with 35 years experience, Andrew Taslitz, a professor at Howard University's School of Law, Jim Harper, Director of Information Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, as well as Mike German, Policy Counsel for the ACLU.
Is this Metro search policy necessary, and is there a sound criteria for it? And fortunately, those questions were answered a couple hundred years ago when our founding fathers decided what the criteria for searches would be and decided that no unreasonable searches not supported by probable cause and a warrant would suffice. And that's really the criteria that should play in all government searches. And of course, there are exceptions that have developed over the years to that, and one at play here that I'm sure the law professor will get into is the special needs exception. But here what we have is a special needs exception that doesn't have a special need. And you don't have to believe the ACLU. Metro Police Chief Michael Taborn has said that there is no specific or heightened threat at issue here, merely an effort to vary Metro's security posture. And that does not qualify as a special need. And, one thing to keep in mind is this argument that this is minimally intrusive. And, I think if you look around, you'll see very few people buy or use transparent bags or see-through bags. Most people have covered bags because they don't want people looking in to see what they carry. And it's not just criminals who carry opaque bags, but most of us, because we have, plenty of things that we carry around that are not criminal, but we would rather not see spilled out in front of other people willy-nilly whenever the government decides they feel they have the right to do that. This isn't a minor inconvenience. This is actually a violation of people's privacy. And interestingly that, one of the factors that comes into it that, again, I think the professor will talk about that has come up in previous cases is the idea that because the search is being conducted in public, it is somehow less intrusive, where I think most people who have something private would think that revealing that in a public place where anybody walking by can see it would be actually more intrusive. And finally, it's simply not effective. I think my co-panelists Jim Harper and Jim Wettick will get into this in more detail, so I won't steal their thunder. But, this type of security approach is what we at the ACLU call security theater. It's merely meant to look good and to make people feel as if the government is doing something to address their security, but there's nothing to indicate that this would actually be an effective methodology. And in fact, what it will do is draw resources away from more effective security measures like real investigations based on evidence and logical leads. I think answering Hope's questions of is it necessary and is there a sound criteria, I think we can rely on what our founding fathers thought the sound criteria should be and require reasonable suspicion, reasonableness, probable cause, and a warrant before the government can search our private property.
That was Mike German, policy counsel for the ACLU. James Wettick, a retired FBI agent with 35 years experience, asked if Metro's bag search policy is just a lot of Mickey Mouse.
First of all, yes, I'm from California, and it's a wonderful place, but it's not bad to come to see Washington, D.C. in cherry blossom time. Like you said, I'm from law enforcement. I spent almost 35 years in the Bureau, the FBI, and when I left, I was responsible for a squad of agents and a number of support personnel and what have you. And as you might imagine, I am pretty pro-law enforcement. My family is really law enforcement because my wife is also an agent. She does all the recruiting for the FBI in Northern California, and she's here today. And so we have a perspective. We're very much for good law enforcement, and we support an active recruitment program to get terrorists. Having said that, since retiring from the Bureau in 2004, I've also had occasion to work a number of terrorism cases, not just in California, a lot of them media-driven, but in Miami, Florida, up in Seattle. It was a case down in Miami, Liberty City 7, and Breonna Waters up in Seattle, Washington, and a couple of today still ongoing in Portland with respect to an ongoing terrorism, and another one just someone, a lawyer just called me up in Toledo, Ohio. And so having said that about being pro-law enforcement and also working terrorism from, if you will, the defense side, what concerns me about this particular, these searches that are being conducted, are they being conducted because it fulfills a safety need, and I think we've mentioned that, or is it conducted because there's a monetary need that, you know, a department is now, sees a grant that's been, you know, allowed for his office to procure, and so they submit the grant and they get the money. And so when I look at this particular situation, it almost smacks that what they're really doing is the monetary need, because I just don't see the response was in because of a situation that occurred, as in Madrid, as in London, where they had the bombings of the subways, because they waited 3 years before they decided to implement this program. And it terribly troubles me, because, you know, like you, the moderator mentioned it a little bit ago, you know, he gives a lecture on constitutional law, and he's got his students, you know, leaving the classroom, going down into the subway, and they're confronted with this, and, you know, and rightfully or maybe wrongfully, they want to get into an argument with the police officer right there because they feel like they're being picked on. They're wondering where this is coming from. You know, after all, do I look like a terrorist? And after all, when you look in my bag and you see that I've got, you know, I ran out of the house today and I have my prescription for headache and I just threw the pills in there. Now, is that going to cause a problem? And do I now have to, because I got that pill in the bottom of my briefcase or my purse, is that going to cause me to have to now do another way to get to work or you know, somehow interfere with my transportation plans? And so it becomes really troubling. Now, that's a law school student. All right, let's ask a former FBI agent with 35 years experience. You know, it troubles me too. You know, as I got back problems too. I could have a pill in my bag or my briefcase or what have you. And so the problem is, what does that scenario get? And then when I ask the situation, is it making me safer so I'll tolerate it, or is it just a lot of Mickey Mouse? And so my problem is, I, fortunately or unfortunately, I sat in those discussions where, because I ran a squad of FBI agents, where the issue of money comes up. And, you know, quite frankly, after 9-1-1, what happened after 9-1-1? We all saw those buildings come down. We saw Congress pump millions upon millions of dollars. And don't think it wasn't lost on all the police departments in the United States as to who could get those dollars and what do they have to do to get those dollars. I nicknamed them on myself terrorism dollars. You know, if you had a terrorism case, you could ask for more cars. If you had a terrorism case, you maybe could get more bodies. If you could say you did a couple of searches and those searches resulted in something happening, you could justify getting more dollars. And so with that information, I know that it is true that there is a safety need, and I know that there's a monetary equation that goes on every administrator's head, inside every administrator's head, when this comes up, and he says to his deputy, let's see what the Office of Justice Programs has available by the way of grants. It's a conversation that happens. And so when you're sitting out there today and we're up here today saying, you know, is this a real need or is this just a way to someone to get money? I say it's a legitimate discussion. And as I said before, I'm very much pro-law enforcement. But I'm telling you, it troubles me greatly to see that they're doing these searches when I think Mike made reference to, you know, those same officers could maybe asking questions somewhere else. They could be conducting other investigation. You know, I like to say, you know, while you're standing there looking at me, what are you doing to catch Bin Laden? Or, you know, the last guy that blew something up. Because it, you know, it doesn't go unnoticed that he hasn't been caught. And it doesn't go unnoticed that a lot of money has been given out. And so when I see, you know, six of you or three of you standing over a woman that might be 70 years old, you know, with a cane, it troubles me. And so is the need safety or is it, you know, because it fulfills a monetary reason and you've been able to get a grant?
That was James Wettick, a retired FBI agent with 35 years experience. David Alpert is the founder and editor-in-chief of the popular blog Greater Greater Washington. Alpert is also the D.C. vice chair of the Writers Advisory Council, which advises the Metro Board.
My name is David Alpert. I am here to give a perspective on this issue from the point of view of writers. And I represent writers in two ways. One is I'm the D.C. vice chair of the Metro Writers Advisory Council. The Writers Advisory Council, or RAC, is a group of 21 writers from D.C., Maryland, and Virginia who are chosen by the board of directors of Metro to provide input to them on different issues. And we meet, we hear presentations about things, and we discuss them, and we give recommendations. In addition, I run a website called Greater Greater Washington, which is a blog about transportation and urban planning issues. Through that, I also hear from many residents of the region, discuss issues, and so forth. This issue of bag searches is very troubling to me and to many riders. Almost everyone that we've heard from is very concerned about this, is very upset to have heard that this happened. Originally, it was announced in December during the board meeting of Metro board meeting, that was the last meeting before the holiday break. A bunch of members were leaving. They were going off the board, they simply announced this, and it sort of went by without a whole lot of attention. Just to clarify before when I keep talking about the Metro Board and the Riders Advisory Council, there are two groups. There is a board of directors of Metro. Metro is an interstate compact. It has D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. They came together to agree to build this transit system. And they have members who are appointed by each jurisdiction to actually make decisions for Metro. Then there's a Riders Advisory Council, which essentially advises that group, the board. So there was a huge amount of rider dismay, discussion. I wrote things about it on the blog. There were people talking on Twitter about how much they hated this. They came up with a hashtag on Twitter called Metro Opens Bags, which was a little bit of a riff on the Metro slogan, Metro Opens Doors. The Riders Advisory Council decided we should have a public forum about this issue because the Metro Board had essentially just let it sail by and not taken any action to say, wait a minute, you know, we should talk about whether you're going to do this. The last time 3 years ago you said you wanted to do this, we had problems with it. You know, don't just go ahead and do it right now. But they kind of slipped it in. So we had a forum in early January. Over 50 people testified, and all but one were opposed to the bag search program. We then passed a resolution from the Riders Advisory Council saying we think the board should not go ahead with this bag search program, should halt the program. Unfortunately, they did not do so. But we were able to get a lot of rider feedback, and we were able to also find out some really interesting things from the police about this program and about their thinking about the program. First of all, for riders, what is it that upsets riders? A lot of everyone here, all the panelists, have given a lot of really persuasive academic, political, practical arguments why this is a bad program. And people cited many of those in their testimony. But overall, I think what it really was is something that was articulated very well by Dr. Gridlock from the Washington Post, who's here in the audience, who said, for a lot of riders, it's not, I don't necessarily know why this program is wrong specifically, I just know it's wrong. That's, or paraphrasing it. So that people simply reacted that this doesn't seem like something that is right. It doesn't seem reasonable. You know, I don't know about the, exactly what the jurisprudence is on the Fourth Amendment or what the, you know, the state of opinions in law enforcement is. This just seems wrong. And that was very clear from what riders had to say. Another thing that riders really reacted to was, why can't the police be using their resources in other ways? Because there have been attacks on the metro, not terrorism related, just you know, kids getting into trouble, hurting people, you know, that needs to be stopped. That's much more of a clear threat than this vague terrorist threat, which, as the police admitted in our meetings, doesn't have any specific, credible, immediate threat whatsoever. So why couldn't, there is, and the police also made it very clear that, yes, it is a matter of resources. They got a grant from the Department of Homeland Security, and therefore they're going to do this. And they're doing a whole number of different programs simply because they have some money and the money is available. But we asked and never got a satisfactory answer, why don't you do some of the other things that you can do over, under the grant that might put the police in a position to stop some of these things? These incidents have been happening on the platforms, not out in the mezzanines. Why don't you have some officers patrolling the platforms looking for terrorists? And while they're looking for terrorists, if some kids are beating someone up, it's okay for the police to stop that person from, you know, getting beat up while they're in the process of being alert for terrorists. So they could satisfy the grant without, you know, in ways that are also constructive for what riders need. But the response was simply that, well, we have to do as many different things as possible just because we should do a lot of things. And that was very much not persuasive. You know, they said it in a little bit more of a little bit less flippant way, but that was still very much the way it came across. And it was essentially what they were saying. We're just going to do different things because we think that it's good to do them. And, you know, as far as the issue that Mr. Harper was saying about assessing the risks, look at all those factors that go into the risks, what's the danger, you know, what's the likelihood something happens, what's the consequence, and so forth. This is a problem that Metro generally has. They're actually bad at assessing this risk when it comes to safety as well, whether trains are likely to hit other trains or buses are likely to get into crashes. They're actually doing a very poor job of making those same types of judgments about, is repairing this particular thing versus repairing that thing going to lead to more safety versus just, let's do everything for safety because of this vague belief that safety is important, so we should sort of do everything for it. The police also, the Metro police officers also definitely showed an attitude that any security measure was a good idea, regardless of its impact on civil liberties, regardless of its specific effectiveness, or the way riders react to it. They were completely baffled at one person's suggestion, one member of the Riders Advisory Council, that maybe it would be a good idea for the police to talk to some people from the ACLU or talk to some riders, talk to some other experts, and have a dialogue about what they're planning on doing and see how to maybe tailor a program to maximize both liberty and rider happiness and security. They cited statistics that almost everyone who's gone through the stations had no problem with the bag searches, essentially to justify that, well, you know, clearly riders are fine with it because, you know, not that many people have objected. But the riders' view, you know, but the feedback that we got was very strong the other way. And the riders' view matters a great deal because for Metro in particular, they need public support. You know, most government agencies need public support, but Metro really needs public support because its public perception is at something of a low given some of its other safety problems. And it constantly needs money that come from the public because the fares don't pay for the cost of running service, which is the case with all transportation systems. So unfortunately, the board of directors decided not to go forward in some very disappointing debates. One member, who's now not on the board anymore, Peter Benjamin from Maryland, gave a long speech about how he was an ACLU member, and he cared a great deal about civil liberties, and he thought that it was vitally important that we protect them, but that he wasn't going to. He, again, you know, not quite so flippantly, but basically said, I don't remember exactly what he said, well, you know, I believe very much that civil liberties are important, but I also have to protect the riders, so, you know, whatever. Again, not quite so flippantly, but that was the way it came across. Other members simply didn't believe that there was any role for civil liberties whatsoever. That another member, Mort Downey, a federal government appointee, said, there's no more important issue in civil society than this security, which I strongly disagree with. So that's where we're at. Unfortunately, the board has been so far unwilling to take much action, but my hope is that, first of all, the strength of the opposition will make them decide to give much more scrutiny to any more programs, and hopefully we can also persuade many of the members, some of whom continue to turn over, that they should take another look at this issue.
That was David Alpert, founder and editor-in-chief of the popular blog Greater Greater Washington. Andrew Taslitz is a professor at Howard University School of Law and author of Reconstructing the Fourth Amendment, A History of Search and Seizure, 1789 to 1868.
Why is this a big deal? And what I want to do in 7 minutes is talk about a little bit of history and a little bit of psychology. So we tend to think of Fourth Amendment issues as privacy issues, and they are partly privacy issues, but they're also about the freedom of movement, freedom of locomotion. And freedom of locomotion was not given a secondary place in the design of the Fourth Amendment. The original Fourth Amendment, 1791, part of the motivating force was that the Royal Navy was just grabbing Americans off the streets to impress them into the Royal Navy, okay? You lose control over your freedom of movement, you end up losing control over a lot of your life. But what I'm even more interested in, and that's never talked about in the case law, about why this matters so much, why you need to care so much even about what look like petty indignities, is that the Fourth Amendment was applied to the states via the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868. So search and seizure practices under slavery and Reconstruction, I think, matter in deciding what the Fourth Amendment means today. And what defines slavery? Part of what defines slavery was control of freedom of movement. Slaves needed passes if they were going to be walking about. The slaves could be stopped for no reason whatsoever. What's little commented upon is that one of the initial abuses that led to the Fourth Amendment were general warrants. Warrants that basically said you could search and seize anyone for some broad set of purposes. Well, the slave patrollers actually had to take exams about search and seizure law, and once they did that, they got general warrants that authorized them to go about and to stop slaves who were out and about, who might be going to see family at another plantation, who might be going to a religious service. And they would be humiliated, and they would be harassed, and they would be abused. This happened to whites, too, though. It happened to white sympathizers, abolitionists, who were, because of their views, were ridden out of town on rails, or they were banished. Their freedom of movement was interfered with. And in the debates over the 14th Amendment, the interference with freedom of movement as central to Fourth Amendment rights was debated and discussed. Now, I'm not comparing what Metro wants to do to slavery. That's not the point I'm making. The point I'm making is simply that freedom of movement has long been recognized as an important component of Fourth Amendment protections, and even when it is a small interference with your freedom of movement, it is a temporary interference with your freedom of movement. And to elaborate on some of Mike's points, when you're stopped in the subway, what's usually happening? You might be rushing to go to your job. Now you're going to be late to your job. You might be rushing to apologize to your wife because you did something to annoy her and you think it's really important to get this over with as quickly as you can. You might be rushing to pick up your kid who is waiting for you at daycare and wondering, where is mommy? Where is daddy? What's going on here? These are not small things. These can be very stressful and upsetting things. And when you see no reason, no justification for these things, I just realized I was looking at that clock and it's not working. Whoops. When you look at these things, you're going to wonder, does race affect why I've been picked out? Am I being bothered for no good reason? Why am I in front of all these people who are going to think I've done something wrong? This is not minor. This is not a petty indignity. Now, how does that hook up with what I want to talk about with psychology? Well, the truth is, even when police are acting based on some suspicion, reasonable suspicion, probable cause, they make mistakes, large numbers of mistakes. And they make mistakes when they're acting in good faith and trying to do the right thing. And why do they make mistakes? Because police are people too. And police and people make mistakes. And what is, there have been psychological studies done that show the kind of mistakes. So for example, individuals, including police, vary in their ability accurately to judge whether something suspicious is going on. They vary in their ability to tell whether someone's telling the truth. They vary in their ability to read faces. They with race and suspicion, there's a fascinating experiment that was done with some police. So they showed to the police a video. Not clear any crime was going on, just a video of certain events in the video. Then after the video, they gave the police a little speech about something, and two control groups. One group, the speech uses crime-related words, violence, assault, attack. The other speech didn't use those words. Then they did a photo lineup to pick out who did this, right? The police who were primed with the crime-related words picked out the offender as being black, and the police who were not primed with crime-related words picked out the offender as being white. By the way, the offender was purposely chosen to be as racially ambiguous as possible. So you can see that very small things, even in the most well-meaning of police, can affect their perceptions about race and about suspicion. Building on this, there can be self-fulfilling prophecies. There are lots of reasons that someone, for example, you might be stopped, you might think race is involved, or you're rushing to get home. You get annoyed. You're a little terse with the police. Police interpret that behavior as, you're trying to hide something. Otherwise, you'd be nice to them. So you must be hiding something. So they get more aggressive. They push harder. That leads to police mistakes. It leads to police errors. It leads to unduly aggressive police techniques. And it adds to the level of humiliation. So long and the short, I'm sure I must have gone over my 7 minutes. I'm not poo-pooing the concern about terrorists. My wife rides the subways every day. When 9/11 happened and I couldn't get in touch with her for several hours, I was in a panic. I worked in a National Academy of Sciences committee on stopping bomb blast terrorism. The threat is real, but these kind of searches do nothing to address that threat, but do a lot for public relations purposes to impinge on the liberty of locomotive motion.
That was Howard Law School professor Andrew Taslitz. Jim Harper is Director of Information Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and a member of the Department of Homeland Security's Data Privacy and Integrity Advisory Committee. Harper recently co-edited the book, Terrorizing Ourselves, How U.S. Counterterrorism Policy is Failing and How to Fix It.
When you're choosing responses, there's a whole other set of processes to go through, and that's cost-benefit analysis, which is rather hard to do because you're balancing, it's easiest to balance dollars against dollars, which economists are very good at. It's more challenging when you're balancing dollars and privacy against security. How do you value security? How do you value privacy? Well, we do it in an inductive way through this discussions like this, society-wide. We're doing that analysis, but the Department of Homeland Security and the Metro Police Department and WMATA could all do a better job of doing that cost-benefit analysis and articulately balancing these things rather than just pushing against the community for measures like this. And one important dynamic in risk management that's very important to be aware of is risk transfer. That is, you may foreclose some risk in one place, but move the risk to another place quite nearby. And if the threat that we're talking about is the idea of a bomber coming onto the metro, risk transfer is very real. In fact, risk transfer is guaranteed because the program as it's currently instituted would have MPD at some locations and not at others. So, and signage, in fact, which is appropriate, but it's poor security, signage that signals the fact that these searches are going on. So someone who is prepared to do something like this, heaven forbid, would go to a different entrance, go to a different metro station, go someplace other than the metro where people congregate. You haven't actually protected the District of Columbia. You haven't even actually protected its people by instituting these searches. What you've done, I think, is correctly characterized as security theater.